So if you're like 50 years old right now and you manage to spend, say, 10 days a year doing the one thing you actually love, you know, your absolute favorite hobby,
Right.
you literally only have about 300 days of joy left in your entire life. I mean, just 300 days.
Oh man, it's just a brutal piece of math.
It really is.
But it forces a completely different perspective
Yeah.
on how we spend our time, you know, and what we actually consider valuable, because society tends to act like this giant airport X-ray machine.
Oh, that's a good way to put
Yeah,
it.
we scan people looking for one very specific recognized shape, like the framed Ivy League degree or the official corporate title, the clinical proof of expertise. And if you don't have that exact shape, the machine beeps and you get pulled aside.
And that is exactly the paradigm we're dismantling today. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring the chapter, Everyone is an Expert at a Few Things, from the book Laws of Life, Book Two. Now, Build the System for Your Life by Jack Spirko.
A fantastic chapter.
Totally. And our mission today is really to break down the core law of this text, which is that you do not need to be great at everything. And you certainly don't need formal credentials to succeed. I see
Yeah.
this all the time, you know, as a career reinvention
Yeah,
coach.
we'll bet you do.
I really do. People come into my office and they're just completely burned out, desperate for a change, but they'll entirely dismiss the one thing that actually comes naturally to them because they think, well, it's easy for me, so it must be easy for everyone.
Yeah.
So they assume it has zero economic value.
Yeah, which is, I mean, as someone who designs adult learning strategies, the biggest hurdle I see isn't a lack of intelligence, it's a lack of permission.
Permission.
Right.
Yeah.
We've been conditioned to believe that every recognized authority was just like born on a pedestal. We completely forget that every expert was a total nobody at some point. And that false assumption hides your own genius.
That is the absolute definition of hidden genius.
Yeah.
And the source material actually illustrates this beautifully with the hallway expert phenomenon.
Oh, I love this story.
It's so real. So picture a real-world seminar or workshop, right? Inside the conference room, you have the paid speakers. The organizers have spent like thousands of dollars to put these people on stage.
Right, the official expert.
Exactly. But out in the hallway, there's always this one attendee. They're a bit introverted, maybe just kind of keeping to themselves. And if you ask why they're there, they give you that standard humble line, like, oh, I'm just here to learn.
Because they're playing the accepted role of the student.
Yeah.
They don't have the badge that says speaker,
Yeah.
so they act accordingly.
Exactly. But if you walk up to them and, you know, bypass the small talk, if you ask them about a specific project they're building or some niche interest related to the event, the shell just vanishes.
They completely lie up.
They really do. They start breaking down the mechanics of the subject, citing books, explaining the underlying why and how. And suddenly, other attendees who are just drifting through the hallway start stopping to listen.
Because genuine enthusiasm and deep competence are just, they're magnetic.
They are. The author actually describes watching this happen. He says he deliberately takes a half step back to create physical space. And within minutes, this semicircle forms. You end up with like 25 people standing in a hallway, completely ignoring the expensive keynote happening in the other room.
Hanging on every single word.
Yes, they're putting on an absolute masterclass for free. And when someone finally points that out to them, they're usually stunned, like, me, give a presentation. I was just talking about something I enjoy.
Which perfectly highlights the major takeaway here, right? Credentials are not the same as competence, and titles are not the same as mastery.
I mean, I want to push back a little on the listener here, though. Why do we assume that if something doesn't have an immediate, obvious economic value, it must not be important?
Well, because modern culture screams at us to hustle. The minute someone realizes they actually possess this hidden genius, they're told to build a brand, to monetize it immediately.
Okay, let me stop you right there because I have to warn against that cultural reflex.
Okay.
In the text, there's a really brilliant reference to that 90s movie, Hope Floats.
Oh, right, with the custom house.
Yeah,
Yeah.
there's a male character who has built this breathtaking, handcrafted home, gorgeous woodwork, custom cabinets, the works, and the lead female character sees it and does what society trains us to do. She tells him, you know, he could make a fortune selling to rich people.
And his response is just, it perfectly captures the danger of that hustle mindset.
It really does. He essentially tells her that if he takes the one pure thing he truly loves and commercializes it, forces it to meet market demands, he'll end up hating it.
Yeah.
If I take my weekend woodworking hobby and force myself to market it and build a website and argue with vendors and deal with angry customers, haven't I just ruined my sanctuary?
You've highlighted the exact dilemma. It's the friction
yeah.
between that hope float scenario and what the book calls the accounting trap. Let's look at the other extreme. You can go to college, get a CPA, work in the field for 10 years. You are objectively an expert at accounting. You have the title, you have the income, the respect.
But you might wake up every single day and absolutely hate your life.
Exactly. And that applies to any field, you know. You can be a highly competent mechanic, a programmer, whatever, and still be miserable. So we have these two polar opposites. You either hate what you do for money, or you're terrified that doing what you love for money will destroy the love.
So what's the synthesis there?
The synthesis is that monetization is entirely optional. Your expertise can remain a private hobby. It can just be a lifestyle advantage that saves you money, or a quiet side income.
But from my perspective as a coach, if you do decide to cross that bridge, if you turn your passion into a business, you have to be the architect of that life. You have to actively build boundaries to protect the love. Otherwise, the operational mechanics of the business will just crush the joy that started it all.
Yeah, absolutely. The question then becomes, why wait to figure this out? Because staying in that accounting trap is dangerous. The text shares a really defining story from the author's own life about this exact turning point.
Oh, the 2008 story.
Yeah, back in 2008, he was a co-owner of several successful companies, making great money, but the actual day-to-day grind was making him miserable. And he happens to listen to a now famous talk by Gary Vaynerchuk.
The Web 2.0 Expo speech, right?
That's the one. The core message was basically that there is simply no excuse in the modern era to spend your life doing things you hate just to pay the bills.
Right, right.
So he's listening to this, and his mindset is shifting. And then he gets into this heated argument on the phone with a business partner who's demanding 100 things at once.
Which is always the catalyst.
Seriously. He leaves the office just to go for a drive to clear his head. He gets on the North Dallas Toll Road, drives 10 miles, and suddenly realizes he isn't just going for a drive. He is subconsciously driving home. Huh. In that moment, he mentally walked out on his job and his equity in three companies. He decided right then to go build a teaching life through his fast-growing podcast.
Okay, time out. Massive red flag.
Yeah.
I need to jump in here with a serious warning for anyone listening, which the source text itself emphasizes heavily. Do not recklessly walk into your boss's office today and quit your job without a very clear path forward.
Fair point. Very fair.
The text is blunt about this. If you quit a job you hate with zero transition plan, you will wreck your life financially. The author even jokes that if you tell your spouse this book told you to quit, they'll throw you under a bus and run over you a few times for good measure.
It's a critical caveat, yeah.
Yeah.
The internal decision happened on that toll road, but he actually stayed for another year and a half to transition out responsibly. But you know, what drove that initial internal shift brings us right back to our opening hook, the urgency of time.
The Gretchen Rubin quote, "The days are long, but the years are short." Yes. Let's expand on that mortality math we started with. Say you are 50 years old. Generously assuming an 80-year lifespan, you have 30 years left. But time isn't measured in years, right? It's measured in experiences.
Right.
So if your absolute favorite thing to do is fish, but your soul-crushing job only allows you to get away for 10 days a year, you don't have 30 years left. You have 300 days of fishing left, total.
Less than a single calendar year of doing the thing you love most stretched agonizingly over the next three decades.
Yeah.
And that assumes your health holds up perfectly until you're 80, which, you know, when you hear the math laid out like that, it forces a pretty brutal pivot for the listener. Do you really want to spend the overwhelming majority of your remaining time trapped in a lucrative but miserable career?
And if the answer is no, if you decide you want to build a life around your hidden genius, how do you actually architect that transition? The book gives us a practical framework by contrasting two distinct approaches. It starts by looking at Tim Ferriss's original 90-day expert formula. From the four-hour work week, that was a massive cultural touchstone back around 2007.
It absolutely was. Ferriss laid out steps like read the top three books in your niche, join relevant trade associations, write articles, offer to speak at local events. And it is a highly effective formula, but its primary engine is external.
Right, it's about optics.
Heavily focused on quickly projecting authority, getting recognized, building a personal brand so that society's X-ray machine accepts you.
And this is where the landscape has completely shifted today. With AI and digital tools, isn't it dangerously easy to just fake those external signals now? We are drowning in internet experts who have the branding, but none of the substance.
Oh, completely.
The chapter even points this out. You have people who shouldn't be trusted to teach you how to drink a glass of water trying to sell you courses on how to install a water heater.
Exactly. Which is why the text introduces a modern upgrade.
Yeah.
The Jack Spirko Modified Rapid Expert Formula. It breaks the process into distinct categories, internal, external, blended, and income generating. And to address the very real problem of faking it, this formula mandates that the internal steps, the actual deepening of genuine competence, those must come first.
Okay, so as the learning strategist here, how exactly are we using modern tools to build that internal competence faster without just, you know, skimming Wikipedia pages?
The mechanics of it are fascinating. The formula suggests using tools like Google's Notebook LM. Let's say you want to master a dense, highly technical subject. Reading a 400-page PDF report can be exhausting, but you can feed that PDF into the AI and ask it to generate an audio podcast or a debate between two AI hosts about the material.
Wait, really? That completely changes the learning dynamic.
It does. Instead of struggling through dry text, you're passively absorbing the syntax, the vocabulary, the core debates of the field, all while you commute or do the dishes.
That's incredible.
And another internal step is interleaving audiobooks. You don't just read the top three books once. You listen to book A, then B, then C. Then you re-listen, but you change the sequence. A, then C, then B.
Why does changing the order matter so much?
Because it forces your brain to build new contextual webs. Mm-hmm. When you listen to book C the second time, you now understand the concepts through the lens of book B. It creates a much more three-dimensional understanding.
Oh, I see.
And you pair this with AI-generated quizzes. You prompt the AI to ask you multiple-choice questions on your topic one at a time. And the critical mechanism here is that if you get a question wrong, the AI must stop and explain why before moving on.
So you aren't doing it for a grade?
No, not at all. You're using active recall and immediate correction to force that knowledge permanently into long-term memory.
And there's also that great piece of advice in the chapter about interviewing people. It says, don't chase the famous celebrities in your niche. You need to find the low-key experts.
It's the practitioners.
Right, the highly competent people who aren't swamped with media requests, so they actually have the time and the desire to talk to you about the real nuances of the craft.
Exactly. And once you've built that rock-solid internal foundation, then you move to the external steps, building the website, creating lead magnets, establishing a social media presence.
And then the blended steps, which do both simultaneously, right? Like taking certification classes or starting your own YouTube channel.
Because teaching is ultimately the best way to learn. When you try to explain a concept out loud to an audience, it immediately exposes your own cognitive blind spots.
It really does. And when you do step onto a stage or behind a microphone, there's a crucial rule the text mentions for presenting. Never lead with how. Bad presentations start with technical step-by-step instructions. You must always lead with why.
Right, right.
If you sell the audience on the profound value of the outcome, they'll happily pay attention to the tedious hows and whats.
Absolutely. And then finally, there are the income-generating steps. This could be authoring books via Amazon KDP.
Yeah.
You know, their self-publishing platform, which completely removed the gatekeepers of traditional publishing.
Yeah, that's huge.
Or it could be as bold as founding competing organizations. The text mentions Dr. Ken D. Berry. He founded the ABS, the American Diabetes Society, to directly compete with the established ADA, the American Diabetes Association.
Why did he do that?
Because he wanted to offer modern low-carb dietary advice that the establishment just wasn't providing. It's a masterclass in establishing authority. You don't ask the existing gatekeepers for permission, you just build a new gate.
Okay, the architecture makes total sense, but I know someone listening right now is thinking, sure, this works for doctors or software engineers, but does this actually work for obscure everyday passions?
The real-world proof is staggering. It works for almost anything.
Like the fishing YouTube channel, that's a perfect example. There's a guy with 300,000 subscribers making fishing content. He generates so much ad revenue from his videos that he essentially stopped grinding as a daily fishing guide.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, he only takes clients out if he genuinely likes them and wants to go for free, or if they are willing to pay an astronomical premium. And because his audience trusts him so implicitly, he just casually connects real estate buyers and sellers in South Florida on the side. He makes more money doing that than a lot of general practice physicians.
Now, that's wild. And the text list, dozens of other hyper-niche examples to prove the point. I mean, people building incredibly stable lives around legal cannabis, sourcing parts for heavy construction equipment, growing microgreens for high-end restaurants.
Microgreens? I mean, it's so specific.
There are people monetizing hiking trails, literally just hiking and documenting the routes, permaculture consulting, knife making, remote computer security, web design, solar engineering.
The sheer diversity of that list is exactly the point. You do not need a mass market product.
Because of the psychology behind the 1,000 true fans model. This is the mathematical engine of the whole concept. You don't need millions of followers. You don't need to go viral. The median salary in the U.S. is roughly $64,000.
Okay.
If you have just 1,000 true fans, people who genuinely trust your expertise and value your output, and they're willing to pay you the equivalent of just one day's median income per year.
Which is what? About $175?
Right. 1,000 people paying you $175 a year generates over $175,000 in gross revenue.
That is life-changing math. When clients come to me and they're paralyzed by the fear that they need to become some massive internet celebrity to escape the accounting trap, we look at this model. Trust scales so much better than virality. You just need to be deeply, consistently useful to a small, dedicated group of people.
And the timeline to achieve that status is shockingly short if you follow the formula. The text shares the permaculture conference story. The author discovered permaculture in 2009. By 2014, just 5 years later, he was speaking center stage at the largest permaculture seminar ever created.
Standing shoulder to shoulder with absolute legends in the field, like Jeff Lawton and Joel Salatin.
Exactly. 5 years from discovery to peer status.
Which brings us to the final practical wrap-up framework the chapter provides, the Genius Formula. It's an acronym that weaves together everything we've talked about, specifically what the author calls Law 2 distilled.
Let's focus on how these mechanisms actually work. The first two are G for gravitate toward real interest and E for educate yourself relentlessly.
Right.
This is about noticing what pulls your attention when nobody's watching. What do you research just for fun? That is your hidden genius. You have to take that casual curiosity and relentlessly educate yourself until you understand the underlying why, not just the surface level what.
But the real pivot happens at N. Narrow your focus. This is where most people fail. They try to be a generalist because they're afraid of alienating potential clients, but depth creates authority far faster than breadth ever will.
Yeah, totally.
You do not need to be the best in the world at everything. You just need to be the absolute best resource for your specific 1,000 true fans.
Then you move to I, which is implement in real life. Competence is forged in action, not consumption. You have to actually build the thing, test the theory, or grow the crop. Most people are significantly more skilled than they realize. They just haven't stress tested their knowledge in the real world.
Which leads perfectly into use teaching to learn. We touched on this earlier, but it is the ultimate hack for mastery. Mm. When you teach, whether it's on a podcast, a blog, or just answering questions in a forum, you are forced to organize your thoughts logically. It bridges the gap between knowing a fact and truly understanding a system.
And finally, S, share with intent. Decide exactly what you want your expertise to be. Is it private and just for you? Is it practical to save you money? Or is it public to build a business? Whatever you choose, share it intentionally.
This entire framework, the Genius Formula, the real world examples, it's all about recognizing that your specific knowledge has value. And if you are listening to this and realizing you need to overhaul your own systems, there are significantly more resources on these exact concepts over at jackslaws.com.
I highly recommend checking out the extended materials there. Again, that's jackslaws.com. Because ultimately, this chapter is arguing that it's not just about what you know, it's about what you are brave enough to build with what you know.
To lock this in, the chapter concludes by providing 3 lines of mental code. These are designed to rewrite your internal operating system. So we're going to read them for you exactly as they are written in the text.
Computer, identify the things that genuinely interest me. Look for them at all times.
Computer, how can I monetize an insert topic here? What can be sold to people interested in it? How can I provide that to them?
Computer, find me ways I can do more insert passion or interest here. Help me design it into my life and design out the things that prevent it.
If you run that code, it changes the trajectory of your life. So think back to that airport X-ray machine we talked about at the beginning, the one scanning everyone for formal credentials and titles. The truth is, you can just step out of the security line entirely. If you only have 300 days of joy left, the question isn't just how you spend them. The question is, what kind of legacy are you building for the people standing in the hallway behind you, just waiting for you to start teaching?